Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing just fine, Justin.
Awesome. I've been cutting sugar out of my diet, and today I ate like a sandwich with a bunch of like weird sauce on it from sandwich place, and it just gave me a headache. So when you cut sugar out of your diet and then you have a bunch of sugar, wow, I feel horrible today after eating that meal. So let's hope I can hold it together here, because being healthy sucks.
Yeah, you know, life's short anyway, man. So make sure you're a friend, not too close a friend, but, you know, a good acquaintance. Yes. And you won't suffer these ills.
Exactly. So what's going on tonight?
Well, before we start, I do want to say we've had some people inquiring about donations, and we've had a few more people donate and buy some shirts. And I sent some more shirts out today. and we're getting more shirts in. So we really want to thank everyone who's supported this podcast, either through promoting us or donating or even just listening to us. A big thank you to all the listeners.
Yes, thank you. Tonight's topic is a sensitive one. A infant suffered a terrible tragedy and lost its life. And a man named Jeffrey Havard was essentially found guilty of sexual battery and the murder of this child. And now he faces the death penalty. So what was the location and the year of this, Aaron?
The night in question is February 21st, 2002. And this evening, Jeff gives his girlfriend, who's lived with him for the past 3 weeks at his trailer on his grandfather's property, I believe.
And this is in Mississippi?
It's in Mississippi. He gives Rebecca money to go get dinner from the grocery store. And that's what he says. He says, you know, get us some dinner from the grocery store. And she takes the money from him and she drives off to the grocery store. Meanwhile, according to him, the infant spits up on herself in the bed. So he proceeds to give her a bath and Rebecca comes back to the trailer and he lets her know, oh, I bathed Chloe and I put her to bed. It should be noted that Rebecca doesn't call her daughter Chloe, even though that's her name. She calls her Maddie.
So we might interchange the names, but Chloe and Maddie is the infant.
Right. If we talk about any testimony that Rebecca gives, she calls her own daughter Maddie. Jeff is just dating her, and that is not their child. It is just Rebecca's child. So she comes back, and she goes to check on Chloe. And long story short, she doesn't see much because the room's dimly lit.
And didn't Jeffrey say she's sleeping, don't wake her up?
He lets her know, yeah, she's sleeping, don't go in there, the baby's in there. And so she goes in to check anyway, and she says that she hears a kind of a gurgle sound, and she notices the baby's eyes flutter. So she doesn't want to disturb the baby some more, so she comes out of the room, and Jeffrey says, go get us some movies at the Blockbuster. So she goes to the Blockbuster to get the movies.
She's gone about 15 minutes at the Blockbuster.
Well, no, she spends 15 to 20 minutes at the Blockbuster.
Okay.
So. But it's actually, if my recollection is correct, it's actually across town.
Okay. So she could have been gone an hour.
She could have been gone for some amount of time. And she returns, I think, with three movies. And Jeff is in the bathroom and the door's locked. She asks him what's going on. He said, oh, I'm in the bathroom. So she goes in and checks on Chloe, and she actually ends up, I think, using the light because she says that Chloe looks bluish and she's not breathing.
Yeah, she notices there's something definitely wrong.
So she's yelling for Jeffrey to come out of the bathroom, and she starts trying to give Chloe CPR. So she does chest pushes and breaths, and she tells him, we need to go to the hospital. So he starts getting dressed. And they head off in the car, and she knows he's driving the wrong way to go to the hospital. So she tells him, there's no hospital this way. We need to turn around and go the other way. So he does, and they get to the hospital. While there, they ask him, you know, what happened to this child? And he says, I don't know. I don't know what could have happened. He ends up getting detained, as does Rebecca, and I believe her mother. So they want to question them.
It was about 20 minutes into the medical staff looking at this child and realizing the child was pretty much too far gone and looking at the injuries of the child and thinking this had to have been abuse. So they reported it to the authorities after less than an hour, more like 20, 30 minutes.
The injuries are such, they said that there was bruising on Chloe's forehead, her nose, her inner thighs, and that she had a torn upper frenulum. It's the piece in between the lip and the gum. It connects those two
the little flap parts of the skin.
So those are her injuries. And then in addition to that, they said that her anus had dilated to about the size of a quarter. And this is, of course, where the case starts to take a turn because you have emergency staff that are looking at a child who they're used to dealing with emergencies. But when it comes down to it, there are people who are qualified to look at these injuries, and we can get into that. But At this point, they're panicked. Everyone who's been around this child is thinking something bad happened. This isn't right. That's what they're all thinking. And because of this, the police are starting to go that direction as well.
So, you know, and I get the ER staff is seeing this child and they're looking for an explanation of what happened and they're not getting one. So when Jeffrey's the only person that's around this child all night, essentially, and he doesn't give any explanation, he says, "I don't know." Well, if you don't know and you're the only person that's been around the child, then there's a problem and we're going to think the worst. And that's just human nature.
Right. I think it's when something's obvious to other people and you're not saying anything, you're not admitting to anything, and you keep deflecting guilt, you're going to look guilty.
Definitely. Well, let's back up a second. That night, they get detained and he's taken to the police station. He's taken there, I think it's like around 11-ish. And he's put in a holding room or a holding cell. And then they start questioning him at...
It's early in the morning.
Yeah, 2-something in the morning. And he maintains, "I don't know what happened."
2 days later, he finally says, "Come on in, guys. I have a statement." And this is where he admits that when he was giving her a bath, he gave her a bath. But then at the end of the bath, he lifted her up out of the tub and turned... And she slipped out of his hands.
And fell and hit the toilet and then back into the, you know, side of the tub. He says that she hit several times on the way down. This is his statement.
Yeah, I remember him saying she seemed unresponsive, so he shook her a little bit. And then I guess that he thought that that would revive her, like shake her out of, you know, whatever she had lapsed into. And... yeah, that's where there's a problem because, I mean, we know nowadays, I mean, this is, it seems sort of obvious, but many people know if you get any sort of head injury, you're not supposed to treat it lightly, especially when it's an infant.
There, it's so easy to get a concussion and just that complexes the problem and complicates the problem.
Or internal swelling that isn't obvious at the time. Mm-hmm. So... the best way to think about it is you're not qualified to know. So let someone who is qualified check them out. And if it's an accident, you could say, "I screwed up, but I'm, you know, I'm here. I want to see and make sure everything's okay." Now, he didn't do that. You could say it's out of shame or
he knew he messed up and he's feeling guilty and doesn't know how to deal with it. Doesn't know how to fess up to it. Doesn't know how to right the situation. So he's trying to, he's hoping that it goes away. He hopes that the baby's just going to get better. It was a quick, you know, bump and hey, she'll bounce back and everything's going to be just fine. I can get the hopeful thinking there, but when the situation turns worse, even dire, I'm surprised that he doesn't at least tell his girlfriend, Rebecca, that he dropped the baby. I'm surprised that he doesn't tell the medical staff that he dropped the baby. It's weird to me. Again, you can say he's just freaking out and feeling guilty, but it just seems obvious to most outsiders looking in that that would be the responsible thing to do, the right thing to do.
So this gets taken to court. And as Justin mentioned, this is a capital murder case. The state alleges that because of the sexual battery, that she died as a result of that.
Yeah, a death in conjunction with a felony makes it capital.
Right, and there's a reason why they do this. It's just like if some people were robbing a store and one of them shoots the clerk, well, they can all be charged with murder because they're an accessory. They, because of the act they were involved in caused the death of another, they're responsible.
There's a difference between an accident and malicious or intent. There's, and in fact, if he would have just dropped the baby, or if you even just kill somebody outright, the death penalty is typically not on the table. It has to be this death or this crime in conjunction with a felony or multiple felony charges. So even if you do murder somebody, if there's no felony connection to it, which would be a little odd, but it's possible, it's not capital. It would just be a life sentence.
Yeah, it's a way that the charge gets elevated.
So at trial, there's a lot of witnesses and people brought on to testify. And mostly it's people brought on by the prosecution, correct?
Right. The defense doesn't really bring that many people forward.
Yeah.
Throughout the entire case.
So who are some of the people that the prosecution brings on?
Well, the prosecution brings on people from the medical staff that worked with Chloe that night.
From the ER, yeah.
But one of the most important witnesses, of course, is Jeffrey Havard's girlfriend, Rebecca Britt, who is the mother of Chloe Britt. And at trial, she talks about how, you know, the timeline of the events that night and, you know, kind of what I gave at the beginning. She talks about how he wanted her to go to the grocery store, then he wanted her to go to the video store. And one of the things she testifies about is why she would need to go to the video store, because they had recently gotten satellite and you can rent movies over the satellite. But he insisted she go to the video store, which is considered across town. So that was sort of a red flag for investigators and for the prosecution.
Well, you can take it two ways. I mean, you can say, well, they're used to just going to the video store and getting movies and watching them. And they just got Dish or satellite, whatever it was. So they weren't used to using on-demand, pay-per-view, whatever it is. But at the same time, if there is a concern about a child in the household and he's sending her out of the household, it looks bad.
Well, there's that, but there's no rush here, right? Why is there a rush to get her to leave when if they don't have experience with the satellite, which is questionable, but if they, let's say they don't, why not use that time to do it? They're obviously just hanging out that night.
Yeah.
Right? Where's the rush here? And how long does it take to figure out how to order something?
Well, if you were to ask my wife, she probably wouldn't figure it out too quick. To me, it's not totally suspicious that she goes out to a video store to get movies. But if there was any ounce of concern for the child, movies on demand or at the video store would not be at the forefront of the priorities this night.
Well, and it underlines the fact that he never said anything to Rebecca about the child slipping out of his hands.
Yeah.
I do want to interject here because I have children. I've pulled them out of the bath, and my daughter especially was very slippery when I try to pull her out of the bath. For me, I would tend to grip her a little more firmly, I guess, because she could slip out. Yeah. So you kind of put your hands underneath their armpits and you kind of have to squeeze a little more than you'd want to because you don't want to drop them. Now she's at the age where she just gets out on her own if she wants. Yeah. But I can attest to the fact that kids can be very slippery.
Well, exactly. There's nothing to grab onto and they're wet. So it's 100%. And if you're using, you know, baby oil or any kind of moisturizer or soap, I mean, it's all just, yeah, it is totally plausible that anyone and every, and I think it happens a lot every year. People do drop their kids when, you know, giving them a bath. It happens a lot. It's not an implausible circumstance or scenario.
She also testifies that he was not in the habit of changing her diapers or feeding her, or that he ever really showed any interest in her, and that before that night, he'd never given her a bath. And here's something interesting that we do know, is that there is a video recording of Rebecca where she gives a statement that night of the event, and she sort of states the opposite. She said that he seemed to really love this child and that he did care for her and that he did change her diapers now and again. The bath thing did seem new even there, but she didn't act like it was unexpected. Like perhaps she felt the way the relationship was going and everything, that he was just taking responsibility of being another adult, the house, taking care of a child.
Yeah, just stepping up.
And that's one way you could look at this, is perhaps he's
really trying to show her that he's...
Right, because And this happens later in the trial, but he had expressed that he wanted to marry her.
Yeah.
That, you know, you could say, well, they were only together a number of months before he had her move in. They'd only been living there together for a few weeks. But I think we can all attest to the fact that we've run into someone that we're really taken by. And it wouldn't really be surprising if he had told some people that he wanted to marry her.
Well, yeah, no.
It doesn't mean that he was going to marry her tomorrow, you know, I mean, the next day. But there's obviously an interest there in moving forward with her, with their relationship.
And when you're dating somebody with a child, that's part of the package. And you either accept that as part of the package or you don't. You could look at it as he's trying to step up and be a father figure because he knows he's going to be with this person for a long time.
The other people who are brought in are people, like we said, that looked at the child, and they all, I mean, these are doctors, nurses, staff, everybody that was around that child, they kept looking at her and thinking there's something wrong here. Enter Dr. Stephen Hain,
the pathologist that did the autopsy.
Right. And so one of the things that he noted was retinal hemorrhaging. And retinal hemorrhaging, I even looked this up apart from this case, because if you read up on the case of Jeffrey Havard, they will talk about something known as SBS, or shaken baby syndrome. And when this is made as a case for bringing charges against someone, they will point at retinal hemorrhaging, because they'll say that it's often caused by rapid acceleration and deceleration of the head, which that can happen in a car accident. But yes, it could also happen if someone shakes someone violently, you know, like a child, an infant. What they say is even though it's commonly used in cases where child abuse is alleged, medically they say you can't just use retinal hemorrhaging as your case. You need to use it in conjunction with other symptoms, other injuries. Pieces of evidence, yeah. Other injuries. So Dr. Stephen Hain is someone who from about the early 90s through 2007 had performed about anywhere from 1,200 to 1,800 autopsies per year. Now, this is important because, and you'll read that he's working other jobs while he's doing this.
That's like five a day.
It's really difficult because the autopsy isn't just examine the body, take notes. There's a lot that is involved in here. In fact, there's a lot of these cases involved. He has to give testimony in court.
Yeah. So if he's doing five autopsies a day and he's testifying in court on these, how does that work out?
He's a busy man, yeah. But he's also very valuable to prosecutors.
Yeah.
Because he's testifying for prosecutors.
And he's not a forensics pathologist. He is just a general pathologist. So there is a distinction there. And the distinction is forensics means he's gathering evidence. He's looking at criminal evidence or that kind of thing. So obviously he's overburdened. Obviously he's doing way too many autopsies and he might not be giving the attention to them that he should. I forgot the medical board thing.
What it is the National Association of Medical Examiners recommends that 325 is the suggested maximum number of autopsies a pathologist should do a year because of what we said. It's too complicated a matter just to run through them the way he has.
That's less than one a day. And that's taking into consideration the person's going to be taking vacation time and testifying at trials and doing other things. So,
and writing up your notes, yeah. And cross-checking.
That seems reasonable.
So there are issues with what he's done. Now, the Mississippi State Department of Public Safety ends up ruling in 2008 that any doctor performing an official autopsy for the state must be certified by the American Board of Pathology. Mm-hmm. So here's the question. Is he board certified? The answer is no. He's not board certified. Now, I have read that he states that the reason why he's not board certified is because he took the exam and he found it insulting to his intelligence. Now, I will tell you that it's insulting to my intelligence that I'm supposed to accept him because he's not willing to take a test that all the other pathologists take and pass.
Yeah. To me, my knee-jerk reaction is when somebody tells me to take a Microsoft certification exam and I've been doing IT support for 20 years, I kind of find it insulting. But at the same time, that's because I'm just fixing a computer. I'm not trying to identify if somebody's been murdered or not. And that would weigh a little bit heavier on me just on that kind of a caliber of situation or, you know, whatever.
So they learned some things about this. They learned that he actually failed his test. So it's not that he walked out on it. He failed it.
So that's different than me refusing to take a Microsoft certification and me failing a Microsoft certification.
The other thing is the department's director has acknowledged that they made this ruling because of Hain. And why? This is putting it mildly, but they've had a decent number of people who were found guilty where their cases were overturned because of his testimony.
Yeah.
So in other words, his testimony was poor. It wasn't correct. And the prosecution has lost cases later on because of that.
Yeah. They say that there's up to 1,000, if not more, cases that they're going to have to go back and re-review that Dr. Hain was the pathologist on.
Will they?
If the prisoners or the people that are sitting in jail have enough money to hire a lawyer, it'll get done.
Maybe.
You know.
But as we talk about this case, I mean, that might be thrown into question. That's all I can tell you. Now, I know in North Carolina, where the Michael Peterson case is, there was a blood expert who testified. And they've had to go back and they're having to redo those cases in court because of him. But that's North Carolina. That's not Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Mississippi may not feel like they're up to it.
They might not care.
There's a man by the name of Jim Hood, and he's the attorney general. Mm-hmm. And he's shown zero interest in revisiting any cases just because of Dr. Stephen Hain's testimony.
Which is ridiculous because I don't think it's humanly possible to do even 1,200, the low number, 1,200 autopsies a year. It's impossible. Unless he had a whole team of people working for him, which he didn't.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com www.mmmedia.com/GenY. So at the beginning of trial, let it be known that the prosecution actually drops the shaken baby charge, the physical abuse charge, and they only go with the sexual battery charge.
Sexual battery that results in her death charge, right? Yeah. The capital murder charge.
Sexual battery in conjunction with her death.
Right. If you read on any of the Innocence websites or you go to Havard's website, you will note that there is this constant barrage against Dr. Stephen Hain. We've already outlined where he is loaded with issues. This guy is questionable at best, right? Yeah, yeah. Like in terms of, I'm not saying he's a bad pathologist. I'm saying he's an inappropriate pathologist for court. And I think that's pretty apparent, but
you're being very fair.
I don't understand the anger towards him because it was the way the prosecutors used him that is of note, not what Stephen Hain actually said, because Dr. Stephen Hain, even though he put forth the shaken baby syndrome testimony, that's gotten rid of. They say that they're not going ahead with the shaken baby syndrome. And when he talks to one of the local papers later on, he actually states that he found no evidence of sexual battery or sexual assault against this girl.
Well, but in the trial, the defense asks for a independent review of the autopsy, and or they actually ask for funds to have an independent expert review the autopsy results.
Someone else to look at it and give forth their testimony for the defense.
The judge denies this request.
Yeah, he denies the request.
He refers them back to Dr. Hain.
Yes, he says that Hain is qualified to make these determinations.
In fact, he says
they don't need anyone else.
In fact, the judge almost pretty much determines that Hain is the only qualified expert to make these determinations and only treats the ER staff as witness testimony, not expert testimony.
Yeah, but you wonder how much that really sunk in at the jury.
It didn't at all.
It's almost as though it all goes in.
So the prosecution or the attorney, the prosecutor,
Tom Rosenblatt.
Yeah, he takes Hain and puts him up on the stand and pretty much says, could this be from sexual battery, these injuries? And Hain confirms, yeah, it's possible. And at no point does Jeffrey's defense cross-examine this, fight it, ask Hain, could there be other possibilities of these injuries? Could there be other things that could cause these injuries, such as the night in the ER, they took the child's temperature with
a thermometer
anally up to 3 or 4 times. So I hate to get graphic, but that could cause dilation.
Well, no, what it could cause though is I don't think it would cause dilation, but I think it could cause the bruise that they found inside of her. That's possible.
But they never get any of this information out in front of the jury. All they got is what the prosecution asks Hain, and that's done. There's no effort there on the defense's side.
If you want to make an excuse for them, I believe it's because when Hain was testifying, he testified at length that did not lead them in that direction. And it was only when the prosecutor said, couldn't this be possible, though?
Yeah.
And he says, yeah, maybe. So you could say a good defense attorney would have jumped on that, not let it got by. But you could say, well, there was so much time spent not going in that direction that they would think, oh, the jury will just dismiss this. And I would say, I don't know if it's true or not, but I have a little feeling that maybe these defense attorneys are sort of in the clouds. Like they don't understand real life. When you have a young child like this who dies, people will want someone's head on a stake.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean they're going to get anybody. But if you're not presenting enough information to deflect that anger away from your client, then you better damn well just be of the mindset that he is going to be sent to death.
This is capital. This isn't a second degree murder. This isn't a manslaughter charge. This is a capital
murder offense, and they're not objecting to anything. They just take the judge saying, oh, refer back to the pathologist and just let it slide. This is ridiculous. They didn't even object to most of the ER staff's quote unquote hearsay of what they witnessed. It's amazing to me that Jeffrey didn't throw a fit, but Jeffrey claims that he just was leaving it in the hands of his attorney to do their job.
And the other thing that Jeffrey does not do is he does not take the stand, so he cannot explain to the jury in his own words what happened, which I think is another big error on his part, because you'll often hear defense attorneys say, well, these people aren't qualified to speak for themselves. They'll screw up the case. But man, in a capital case like this, where a child has died, I think it would have gone away to help him if he could have gotten up there and told the jury in his own words, I screwed up. But I didn't mean any harm, and I didn't do what they said I did. I just, going back, I wish I could have just taken her to the hospital myself. But he didn't do that. He didn't say it. And so he's letting the attorneys battle it out, and yet it's his butt on the line.
You're exactly right. And I don't want to divert off topic for too long, but most defense attorneys inform their clients to not take the stand. And I think that's 100% a mistake. And I am not in a courtroom every day, so they might think that people can look at this guy and just not like the way he looks or the way he talks and think he's guilty. But I would like to think that there's a little bit more of a human connection there. And if you see this person actually speak and interact and try to give their side of the story, that gives you a little bit of sympathy for them, whatever that might be. And I've seen other people give their own statements to the jury. The actual person being charged with the crime actually get up and make their own opening statement, not their lawyer. And in those cases, they've been let off, which is pretty amazing to me. But I think it's an absolute mistake for a lot of these people not to take the stand.
Well, their concern is that they'll be cross-examined and that the prosecutor will tear them apart. But this is a very simple scenario of what we're talking about here. So we've already seen what happens when the police interrogate him. We have an understanding of how that goes down. So when it comes to the prosecutor, if Jeffrey's up there defending himself and he's saying, I never meant any harm, I didn't do this, and he starts crying, he's a human being. That gives him a shot, I think.
Yeah.
If he's just sitting there stoic in his chair and he doesn't have a voice, the jury gets to decide who he is.
Yeah, what does the jury have at this point to decide who he is? They got a guy that has sent his girlfriend away multiple times during the night, has not confided in her or the medical staff of an injury that resulted from his actions. It just looks horrible for him. Intentional or not, he made a lot of bad decisions that day and that week of the incident that a lot of people aren't going to forgive him for. Now, whether or not the sexual battery could be proven, well, it wasn't disproven. So guess what? He got this capital murder charge because, one, his defense didn't do anything, and two, the prosecutor didn't have to do much because he's got everything. The prosecution's got everything on their side. They got a dead child and a pathologist that will pretty much say whatever they want.
Well, and don't forget the timeline that he sent Rebecca away a couple of times, that he didn't want her going in the room the first time.
I think it would be easy to say that most people probably would have found him guilty unless they were just adamantly against the death penalty.
Well, and then that would be an anti-death penalty vote, not an anti-guilty vote.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is a lot of this case is built upon his errors in the beginning. If he had just come clean right away and just even taken her to the hospital, it would have given him a fighting chance, because then he's telling everyone, hey, I did this, I think there might be something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, he keeps covering up for 2 days, and then he supposedly comes clean. To me, that can be a real issue. Now, when it comes down to the trial, there are two prosecutors, basically, and two defense attorneys that are arguing the case in their final closing statements. Tom Rosenblatt leads the way, and he makes it clear that there's this timeline of what we just talked about, how he has her go to the store. She comes back. He says, this is what Jeffrey says. He says, shh, don't go in there. Don't go in where the baby is. She goes in anyway, but the room's very dimly lit because she doesn't want to wake the child. And then after she comes out of the room, then now he wants her to go get movies. And he says, now go to Blockbuster, and hands her money. She comes back from Blockbuster and Jeff's locked in the bathroom, and she finds her daughter is bluish in color and not breathing. So you can see how they're already laying the case out for the jury, saying, this looks like someone who's guilty. Now, again, you can say he's maybe just feeling guilty, but not because he assaulted her, but because he made an error. He dropped her, and then he made more errors because he felt guilty for dropping her.
Yeah, he feels responsible for her death or for her injuries, but...
But the prosecutor's laying this out as, this is a dead child. This is the person who was left alone with her. She looks really bad.
Yeah.
She has all this bruising, her lips separated from her gum, and her anus is dilated by quite a bit. Now, what does the defense say? Well, his defense attorney starts off with, there's no DNA that shows that any part of him was in her. There's no tearing. And Jeffrey he didn't go and wash his clothes. And that even though he had requested to be able to take a shower before he was taken to the station, he wasn't granted that so they could check him out. There was no problem there. And that Chloe, according to Jeff, had slipped out and dropped, you know, about 3 feet, maybe more, and had struck the toilet. And if they really thought that there was sexual battery here, they said that they found no evidence of any object that would have been used in this crime, that would have been used to penetrate her. And they never really checked into him either. They checked him for DNA, and he offered everything. He didn't resist any of the DNA, the hair. Yeah. Any of that. He gave them whatever they wanted. So they're trying to show that there's nothing forensically to show he committed crime here in terms of pieces of evidence, and that he was very cooperative, that at no point did he say, oh, I don't want to give this up, or you'll have to get a court order to do this. He didn't fight them. And they point out that they spent a lot of time at the trailer and they just weren't able to find anything that had been used in the crime. So you could say they're trying to lay out that they don't have enough evidence to really go after him. So this might explain why they don't do enough "I object, sir" during the trial, because they feel like, well, they don't really have anything. They're making leaps here based on their interpretation of the events.
Yeah, but just because they can make the leap doesn't mean a jury can make that leap. Doesn't mean a jury sees it the way they do. They have to paint that picture out, and I don't think they do at all. They do in their closing statement, but they haven't proved anything. I mean, I think back to my jury duty. The defense didn't do anything. All she said is he didn't do it, and there's no fingerprint or DNA evidence. But she doesn't contradict anything that the prosecution said or did. So there was no leap there for me, and there's no leap in this case for me either, as far as when you go through the court documents of why these people found him guilty. It's because his defense didn't do anything.
So, you know, the defense makes their statement. Well, the other prosecutor, Ronnie Lee Harper, the district attorney, starts laying out, oh yeah, well, here's what we're seeing here. Lays out how the entire ER staff just knows something is wrong. Some of these people, you know, doctors, nurses, some of these people have 10 years experience there, and they've never seen anything. They've never seen a child come into their ER room like this. And they talked about how Jeffrey admitted lying. You know, that 2 days later statement he gives, he admits he lied to him. I didn't tell you what I did. I should have told you. I didn't tell you. So he lied right there. It's a big lie. Then they talk about how after she had fallen, that Jeffrey admits that he did shake her. And he says he was alone with her. He admits that he may have been rough with her when he was wiping her because she needed cleaning. I don't know that I want to get into everything that happens to a child when they've had an accident, or especially after they start experiencing swelling in the brain. But they asked Jeffrey, could you have gotten rough with her? And Jeffrey's statement is, it's possible. Maybe I was too rough with her. Maybe I went too far in on her. And Ronnie Lee Harper says the most incriminating statement by Jeffrey, and this what he's saying here is he says this is the thing that really convinced him beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's got someone who's dangerous, malicious here in this court case. He says, Jeffrey says, when they ask him, you know, how did she end up this way? How could she be in this state? He says, I can't explain it. I don't know. I don't think I did it. I don't recollect doing it. I don't remember doing it. And I know some people will sit there and say, wait a minute, he's not admitting anything there. The problem is most people would say, if you're accused of doing something this heinous
to your child,
to a child, because remember, it's not his child. Yeah, it's his girlfriend's daughter. You would say, no effing way. This is not something I would ever do. You know, this is no way. You would deny it over and over and over again. He doesn't do that here. Is he, you can, and this is where you can extrapolate it out. You can say, is he really guilty? Is he just, he's now going, but I, you know, I wasn't in my state of mind. I don't remember doing it, but I did it. Or is he saying, I'm already broken, so at this point, I'm almost giving up.
Yeah,
it's possible. Yeah. I mean, because you have to understand, he's seeing everything slip away. He's in custody, and he sees that he's not coming out, and he may be losing hope. That's one way to look at it. But on the other hand, when he says, I don't recollect, I don't think, I don't remember, there should be no clearer thing in his mind at this point. It's just like we talked about before. If something momentous happens,
you remember.
You remember. It is burned into your brain. If he loves this woman, Rebecca Britt, and he's taking her daughter out of the bath and she slips out, that's not something you'd forget. That should be replaying in his mind over and over again out of guilt, out of wishing he'd done this or that, you name it. There's no way he can't remember. This statement right here is what gets this district attorney all over him, and I bet the jury all over him, in my mind, when I read through the court documents.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Why would you not know? I mean, I can say, I can understand when he says, I don't know how this happened to her. Like, if you say, oh, look, it appears that, you know, the baby's been sexually assaulted. How did that happen? I can understand him saying, I don't know how that would happen. I don't know how that would get it.
But, right, because that's, you know, if he didn't do anything sexual to her, he would say, I don't know.
Yeah.
And we'll get into the more of that
but just saying, I don't remember, I don't recollect, it's just, I think the guy's not very bright.
You and I discussed this before we started. I can't say that he's not very bright. He's not a dummy. You could say that he's in a situation that he just panicked, that he did not react well to. I get that, but I think he's bright. I think he's a bright guy.
In this situation, the words that are coming out of his mouth are really poor.
Harper goes on, and he goes on to actually try and lay out what he thinks happened. He thinks that Jeffrey was doing something to the child and that she started to freak out because the six-month-old has no voice. She can scream. She can cry. Mm. And he thinks that he shook her violently to get her to stop crying. And that what followed was her head hit something from him shaking her. And of course, he says that since Jeffrey was in the locked bathroom when Rebecca got back and she was gone a little while, that he had time to clean up, that he had time to do the best he could to clean himself up, because the officers are actually asked, when you went to the trailer to check it out. Now, remember, this is a trailer. This is not a mansion.
No.
The officer states that they didn't go and check to see, to verify whether or not the shower had been used, possibly by Jeffrey.
Yeah.
Prior to the child being taken to the ER.
So there's not a lot of investigation going on, or proper investigation going on, that could have helped the prosecution state their claim, or even help the defense say, no, he wasn't concealing a crime.
Right. The defense even states that when you hear from the officers, that it doesn't even seem like they really did investigate to see if he had used anything on the child.
And I guess, just to give that point of view, is
if the officers only know that it appears this baby was assaulted somehow from hospital staff, they don't know where it happened. They don't know what's going on yet. They might find out later, but at that time, at that night that this incident's going down, they don't know to go check the bathroom. They don't know to rope off the entire trailer as a crime scene yet.
Right. They even say that at the hospital where the child passes away officially, that becomes the crime scene.
Yeah.
But, and I have this trouble with, we've covered a few cases like this where, why not just wander around?
Yeah.
You know, use your gut instinct. Wander around, take everything in, see if anything strikes you as odd.
Or out of place. See if there's blood anywhere, like in the bathroom.
It's almost like they're just not on red alert yet. And I'm sorry, but there was a child who had, you know, injuries to it. And something may have happened. So why not just go in and take it in? They don't do that. No. So for me, we could nitpick this and say, well, they dropped the ball here, they dropped the ball there.
Both sides dropped the ball.
But since the prosecution won their case and he's sentenced to death, it's not really on them anymore.
No.
So post-trial, Jeffrey can appeal. Now, they write up this long appeal.
Mm-hmm.
They go through an attack. They attack it from every angle you can imagine. And I read through the appeal. And I won't bore you with all the details. You can look it up. It's easily found on the internet. But the state makes a very good case as to why almost all of these items do not count. Some of them are because his defense counsel doesn't object at the time when mm-hmm. certain statements are made. So that's, as they put it, it's a strategy. If the defense doesn't think that's where they need to focus, then let it go. That's a strategy. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You can't go back. There's a long list of these things where they use prior judgments in cases to show how the defense may have brought up things in the appeal, but they don't matter. They don't count. They don't meet the level required to justify going back and changing the result of this trial.
Getting a retrial, yeah.
But there's one thing on this entire appeal sheet that I was reading that stood out to me. Legally, they're correct that when they asked for another pathologist to take a look,
an independent expert, to
someone who was not Dr. Stephen Hain, to come in and look at what happened with Chloe, the court decided at the time that they weren't going to grant that request. Now, in the appeal, they state, well, the defense didn't really push that. They made the request. It didn't work out. They moved on.
And they say that they don't understand the autopsy results and they don't cross-examine Hain when he's up on the stand. So,
but yeah. Here's the problem I have. This man has been sentenced to death. And there's a question here because for me, no one ever states, no pathologist, because they've had outside pathologists looking at this, no one ever states they feel like she suffered sexual battery.
And even Hain, the original pathologist, 8-10 years later, wrote something up about it and said that he could not conclusively say that her injuries were caused by sexual battery or by shaken baby or anything. He said those were just possibilities. So even the original pathologist doesn't confirm the prosecutor's findings. But yeah, that's just insanity to me that the evidence does not 100% seal that this was what the prosecutor says it was.
So the problem I have with it is in this appeal, it states that they wanted an outside expert to come in. Now, keep in mind, we found out now that Hain is not an expert.
No.
We also found out that the ER staff, which they were using to basically bolster the sexual battery charge, are not legal experts. The judge even said so.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, I get that the judge has discretion. He can decide whether to grant this request or not. I would say all that we know now, all that's put forward, I think denying this appeal, I think is a bad choice because what they're doing is they're saying, we don't care if you have evidence that we prosecuted you the wrong way. Because as you stated earlier, manslaughter could have been up on this.
Second degree murder.
Anything. Now, I know that's on the defense. The defense, it was incumbent upon them to make sure those charges were included as possibilities for the jury. They didn't want to. they were riding on the, they can't prove a case against you, Jeff. Don't worry about it. But when your pathologist you're using as the expert is found to not be an expert, I don't care that they made a ruling, you know, in 2008 that he's barred. If they're going back on other cases, if they've already shown that testimony he gave, yeah, multiple cases that testimony he gave was wrong, in error, and he was getting people sentenced to time when they didn't deserve it, I don't understand the denial of this part of the appeal. I just don't. I mean, I understand that they can, legally they can do this, but I think it makes you a bad person to follow the letter of the law blindly against somebody. I understand the blind law where you say they're not going to judge anybody. We don't know what color you are. We don't know what religion you are. We don't know what your sexual orientation is. That's fair justice. But when they turn a blind eye, when there's evidence staring at them that they may have gotten it wrong, that's a real problem. Because trust me, reading through the trial transcripts, I can nod my head when the prosecutors are talking. I get everything they're saying. But the problem is you can interpret it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't find some of the things that I would think would be present. You know, when I was reading about what happens to, you know, unfortunately, what happens to a child, I can understand these pathologists are saying, we don't see evidence of this sexual battery.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
When you're seeing all this and you're trying to put him away on that very charge, and you're saying the outside expert didn't matter, at this point, you are anti-life.
Yeah.
You want to kill people and you are just trying to get reelected. I'm sorry. This attorney general here, this Jim Hood, he can say, oh, I'm a champion for children. Well, guess what? Maybe most of the time you are. Maybe you've helped a lot of children out. But you know what else you are? You're bad because you're not being fair about it. So just because a child dies, and it's very unfortunate that it does, doesn't mean that someone's head has to roll. You better damn well make sure you get the right head, because at this point, in this case, I get why you guys are suspicious. I get how you can put a case together, but I don't get how you can deny someone their right to a fair trial when this kind of evidence is staring at them in the face.
The right to their defense, their right to an analysis of the evidence. And, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but I see a lot of similarities in other cases we've done, such as the Heyman Lee one, where they didn't have an expert to analyze the cell phone tower data. They didn't have experts to do other things. And here we are, a guy is on death row. And I guess this is just collateral damage in our quest for justice.
Well, but unlike those other cases, this case is very simple. We don't have multiple areas where someone could have been, or who was with who, or what phone.
This is straight up.
This is a guy at his it's a trailer.
Yeah.
It's not even a big house. It's just a trailer. So a very small contained area, right? I just don't understand how this can be blown up this way, and then someone can just be tossed to the wolves when they have this kind of an issue staring at them. I just don't understand it.
I guess the way I look at it is, to me, it's no longer a guilt or innocence thing. It's low-hanging fruit. It's, oh, this is going to be an easy conviction for me. I admit, when I'm at work and I get requests, you know, or tickets in to work, I'll look for the easy ones first. Go work those real quick, get those out of the way, and move on to the harder ones. But here we are. This is people's lives that are on the line, and it's being treated as if it's a day job. If I'm going to I mean, I don't really agree with the death penalty, but if I am going to sentence someone to death, I want that package sealed up tight. I want all my T's crossed, all my I's dotted, and to really nail this person. This is why they're guilty. This is why they are no longer human and deserve death. And this doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen in a lot of capital cases. And I find it's very poor of the prosecution to not want to go that extra mile to really prove their case. But I guess they don't have to, because, hey, they didn't have to in this one.
Well, yeah, and I really firmly believe, looking through the transcripts, that I don't think the defense was necessarily... You can say they're ineffective because they lost. Well, anybody can say that. But I got the feeling they just really believed that the without the DNA, without the some of these terrible pieces of evidence that would normally be seen, you'd think, in some of these cases, that the prosecution didn't have a chance. Well, again, I have to drive this home. When you have a dead child on your hands and there was only one person around at the time, I don't care that the burden is on the prosecution. I'm sorry, but that's not true. Not in a case like this.
No.
The burden is on the defense. You can say whatever you want legally about how our laws are drawn up and how we're supposed
innocent
to see things.
Innocent until proven guilty, all that.
That does not happen in a case where a child is killed. Does not happen. It just, you can't. They already had, you know, when they did their jury selection, there was one juror who said that she had a niece who was raped and she's not sure she could be fair about this. She made it onto the jury.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm serious. This is one of the things that was brought up. Okay. They went through and talked about how all these different jurors were not selected because of one reason or the other. And in fact, you'll hear people argue this in this case. They'll say, oh, well, his defense was ineffective because they should have brought up that this person should not have been included. Well, guess what? The defense got up. And again, the appeal was denied because they say this was just a strategy. It's not an effective counsel. It's a strategy that they told the court, we're not going to draw this out, so we won't ask the same questions. So if the judge comes out and asks something that's relevant and it's on our list, we'll cross it off. We won't ask it again. The judge looked at all the jury members and asked them, can you find, like he was basically asking for and against death penalty. Can you... Are you just totally against death penalty or are you just totally for it? He was trying to get a gauge of the people there because they don't want anyone that's too biased going in. This woman spoke up at that time. Now, later, when the judge gets into it further and asks for more details, she doesn't talk about it again. She stays quiet.
And the defense never questions or brings her up or even just says no and pulls her down. Because
they should have taken a note.
Yeah.
I don't think they noted this in there. See, there's no way for them to have it in their head every time a statement is made to put it. Do we do this during the podcast?
Yeah.
You know, I'll get ready to say something and then you start making a really good point and I'll forget what I was going to say. And then after we're done with the show, I'll think, why didn't I bring that up?
Yeah.
So they need to have their little notepad out and they need to have their little pen ready. And if they find something like that, they need to note it down. This is juror number 9 or whatever it is and come back to it. And say, I'm sorry, but you spoke earlier and I want to address what you mentioned.
They don't even have to come back to it. They could have said, you can go sit down now. They could have just pulled her immediately from that jury box.
Well, either way, I'm just saying they never did anything with her. There were at least 2 jurors on there that were very questionable. Now, I'm not going to make a big deal out of it because, you know, there's more than 2 jurors.
Yeah.
There were 10 women and 2 men on this jury.
I guess, sorry, not don't mean to cut you off, but they pulled people out of my jury box just because they were related to law enforcement.
They asked them if they knew Jeffrey Havard, if they knew anyone involved in the case, and would remove people that knew someone involved. And
but see, I actually would argue that just because somebody knows law enforcement or just because somebody even might be know somebody that's involved with the case, that to me is less of a problem than I've had a family member or child that has been assaulted sexually. To me, that makes you totally biased. Like I can say, well, Aaron's a cop and I know Aaron, but I can still look at this case and say, well, Aaron investigated correctly, or Aaron didn't investigate correctly, or Aaron just was handling the evidence and had nothing to do with the arrest and trial or anything. I can separate myself from that. But if I have a personal rooted situation that's going to bias me, like a family member that's been raped or assaulted, yeah, no. That juror needs to come out of the jury box.
Yeah, because if the juror is sitting there thinking, oh, I want to burn you alive.
That's it.
They probably aren't listening to the whole trial. And again, if you look through the trial transcripts, and you can get them from the website that supports Jeffrey, it's titled freejeffreyhavar.com. If you go there, you can find a lot of information. I find it interesting because I always say, if you look through trial transcripts, you can learn a lot. And I've noticed on these pro Jeffrey Havard websites, they don't tell you everything. They don't point out things that are questionable about Jeffrey. I guess what I'm trying to say is I think everybody should look deeper into cases than just what they've read in an article. And at the end of this one, I'm going to say it on the record. I feel like by denying his appeal on the grounds that the court had the discretion not to bring in an expert when they already had one, when that expert has been found to be not an expert because he failed his exam and can't get certified, legally they can do that. But I think it makes them bad people. And I don't think it's right. And I think right now they have a guy in prison who's on death row who I don't think should be there based on the way they ran the trial. I can get a lot of their statements. I can see how they think he's guilty, but this right here is a big problem for me, and I can't accept it.
I think it's sad that ineffective defense isn't a good enough reason when it can be systematically proven. I think that sucks, because whatever case we're looking at, when the defense does zero, I have a big problem with what the judge did, but at the same time, the defense didn't follow it up with anything. They didn't pursue an expert of their own. They didn't cross-examine the current expert, nothing. And for that to happen, I know you can say, well, it's a strategy and they had a bad strategy and we can't redo it because of that. I have a problem with that. I know it's a little bit looser. I know it's not applicable to reality, but I have a serious problem with when a defense takes no strategy and that's considered a strategy.
Well, they did try to deal with it. Again, they did try to deal with it. They tried stating that these injuries would come from a fall.
Yeah. So essentially at this point though, he filed for an appeal and he was denied because the current defense, the current lawyers were pointing out these things and these weren't good enough.
There was a long appeal that was filed that was denied, but there are levels to appeals. So
he's not done yet.
In April of 2015, the Mississippi Supreme Court granted Jeffrey Havard permission to request an evidentiary hearing. And again, this is based on their issues with their findings that they used against him in court. And there are other pathologists who have taken a look at the reports and said, yeah, this all could have happened from a fall. It could have happened the way he said it did. That would make sense. So they're not coming out and saying, oh, he's innocent. No, these pathologists look at it clinically and they're just stating that what he said is not inconsistent with what they looked at.
Yeah, his only inconsistency was not fessing up to the accident immediately. That's pretty much it.
Right. So we'll wait and see what happens, but and I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea. I would hope that, and again, for me, it does come down to this pathologist. I really wish they would let him have a hearing. And I don't care if they could say, well, we don't want your pathologist. Find someone from another state. Go somewhere else. Get another pathologist. Have them look at the evidence and go from there. Because to me, it's going to show that their case against him, while they have good circumstantial evidence, their true evidence, all this scientific stuff, the pathology report, this is not good. This is not something that's enough to
seal
to seal the case against him And I really hope he can at least have this hearing and that another expert can be heard on this case rather than their non-expert, Dr. Stephen Hain.
Yeah.
Even though, again, I don't blame Hain. He's a guy that's overworked, taken on too much work. And the prosecution was able to use him however they wanted because they asked the questions.
Yep. The and defense it's not, didn't.
He's not there to argue with the prosecution.
No.
And scientists will often make statements like, yes, it's possible. Now, if he's being asked questions in a court, so if they actually said, what would your percentage be on the possibility of that? He might have said 0.02% or something. We have no idea.
Yeah.
Now, the prosecution's not there to make it easy on Jeffrey Havard.
No.
So again, to me, Hain's not the problem here. He's just the issue here.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully they get this straightened out.
Yeah, I agree.
And I guess I've been harsh on the prosecution. They did a great job on this case. I really believe so. But they also, to me, knew that they were sending a guy to prison, to death row, despite a shaky pathologist and despite shaky forensic evidence.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.